to an interior pocket of his tweed jacket and removed what looked to be a small white card. Despite his spirit of resistance, James unclenched one hand from his umbrella and took the offered card. It looked like a lady's visiting card, although it was done in simple white rather than the colorful cards now in vogue in England and America, and was embossed with a subtle white rectangle within the rectangle of the card itself. At the top of the card, within that plain border, there were five hearts embossed. Four of the hearts had been colored in blue, with what looked to have been hasty strokes of a colored pencil or crayon. The fifth heart was left uncolored, blank. Henry James knew immediately the more general meaning of what the hearts signified. He had no clue as to what the empty heart or the single line of print below the hearts, a single sentence that looked to have been added by a typewriting machine, might mean. She was murdered.
When he visited me asking for help 2 years ago, Edward Hooper, Clover's brother, said that he had received exactly this card every 6 December, every anniversary of his sister's death, since the first anniversary of her odd death in 1886, said Holmes. And I notice, Mr. James, that you instantly recognize the significance of the 5 embossed hearts on the card. Mr. Hooper told me that the 4 surviving members of the 5 hearts also annually received such a card. This, he said he knew for a certainty, included Mr. Henry Adams, although Adams had never spoken to the others about it.
Ned Hooper was not one of the 5 hearts, James said numbly. Holmes nodded.
No, and he believed that he was the only person who was not one of the 5 hearts who annually received this note. But, of course, he could not be certain of that.
Clover Adams' death was by her own hand, repeated Henry James. It is of no one's business except her husband's, and Henry Adams does not speak of that time or that event. He came close to death himself from sheer grief after her actions.
What of her brother's suspicions? Asked Holmes.
They are misplaced, said James. These cards, if they are or were actually being sent, are an example only of someone's sick and perverted sense of humor. As I said, melancholy, and perhaps some not infrequent sense of persecution, run in the Hooper family. I have not met Mr. Edward Hooper. I always heard him referred to as Ned, but I am sure that he was and remains mistaken.
Mr. Edward Hooper is dead, said Sherlock Holmes.
Dead? James could hear how small the single syllable sounded amidst the carriage and pedestrian background bustle of Paris's joyous Rue de la Paix at night.
He attempted suicide this past December, the day after the December 6th anniversary of his sister's so-called suicide, by throwing himself from a third-story window of his home on Beacon Street in Boston, said Sherlock Holmes. Although badly injured, he survived and was taken to a Boston asylum. Hooper appeared to be recovering, both mentally and physically, but 2 weeks ago he came down with pneumonia. The disease carried him off.
This is terrible, muttered James. Horrible. Henry did not write me of these events. How is it that you, Mr. Holmes, who say that you have been in the wilderness of the far-flung empire for these last 2 years, should be aware of such recent events in America when I am not.
Every good Englishman is behind the times, said Sherlock Holmes.
James blinked either his lack of understanding or his disgust at hearing the ancient joke in this context. Perhaps he meant to signal both.
I have read my London newspapers even when, as in India, they were weeks out of date, elaborated Holmes. Here in Paris, they are quite current. And the choice of American newspapers here, including the newspaper from Boston, which carried the news of Edward Hooper's suicide attempts and final death by pneumonia, is very extensive indeed.
James took a ragged breath and looked back toward the beckoning lights of his hotel. Holmes took a half step closer until he gained James's full attention again.
You see why I owe it to Ned Hooper, to fulfill my promise of taking up the case of his sister's death.
There is no case, James said again. There was only the tragedy of her suicide more than 7 years ago. The case, as you so melodramatically call it, is closed.
Do you remember the cause of Mrs. Adams' death?
Asked Holmes. Henry James knew that he should turn away at that point, go into his hotel, and never talk to this madman again. But he did not move. At the depths of her melancholy, when she was alone for a few moments one Sunday, Clover drank a potion that was part of her photographic developing chemical apparatus, James said at last, rather than continue suffering the silence. It contained arsenic. Death was instantaneous.
Death from that type of arsenic, potassium cyanide, is relatively quick, but rarely instantaneous,
Holmes said calmly, as if he were discussing railroad timetables.
She would have eventually asphyxiated, but only after long moments of the most exquisite agony.
James raised his free hand as if he could shield himself from such words and images.
Who found her body? Persisted Holmes.
Her husband, Henry, I am certain, said James, coming very close to stammering. He suddenly felt very confused. Part of his consciousness wished that he had been alone to do what he had planned to do on the sidewalk along the Seine.
Yes, the police report said it was Henry Adams who discovered her, on the floor and comatose before the fireplace, agreed Holmes. This was on a certain time of the morning, on Sunday, 6 December. Does that time of day and week bear any significance for you, Mr. James?
No, none at all. Other than, do you mean because it was the time each Sunday that Clover had, for years, set aside to write to her father, especially during his illness? Holmes did not answer. Instead, he took another half step closer and whispered,
Henry Adams had told friends that he never left his wife alone at that hour, on those Sundays, precisely because he feared that her melancholia would overpower her reason. And yet on that Sunday, the 6th of December, 7 years ago, she was alone, at least for several moments.
I believe that Henry was on his way out to see his dentist about a tooth that was giving him...
Are you interrogating me, Mr. Holmes?
Not at all, Mr. James. I'm explaining why your presence during this investigation is of the utmost importance.
I will not betray a friend, Mr. Holmes.
Of course not, said the detective. But would it not be a case of betraying both your friend Henry Adams and your former friend Clover Adams, if it were murder, and if no one even bothered to look into it?
It was not murder, James said for what he vowed to be the last time. Clover was one of the first, and I would venture to say the preeminent, female American photographers of her era. Her work was ethereal, otherworldly. But that very quality of otherworldliness added to her inherited tendency toward terrible melancholy. On this particular winter day, that tendency must have overwhelmed her, and she drank some of the easily accessible chemicals from her photographic laboratory, a mixture which she must have known contained arsenic.
And who gave her those specific developing chemicals? Asked Holmes. I assume she purchased them herself, snapped James.
If you are again hinting of any shade of guilt accruing to my good and honest friend Henry Adams, Holmes held up a gloved hand.
Not at all. I happen to know that it was a stranger who provided those chemicals to Mrs. Adams, a brother of a female friend, a certain Miss Rebecca Lorne, whose acquaintance Mrs. Adams had made quite accidentally in Washington. That friend, Miss Lorne, was there waiting, according to police reports and newspaper accounts given to me by Ned Hooper 2 years ago, when Henry Adams came downstairs to go on his dental errand. Miss Lorne told Adams that she had dropped in to see Mrs. Adams and asked if she was receiving. Mr. Adams said he would run upstairs to see if his wife felt up to seeing a visitor, and then he found her body on the floor. Again, you seem to be insinuating, began James, showing the fiercest scowl he could manage. Usually even a much lower wattage version of that scowl served to silence any presumptuous or personally trespassing interlocutors. Not so this night with Holmes.
I am insinuating nothing, said Holmes. I am merely explaining why you and I will be catching the early express train to Marseille at 6:15 tomorrow morning and be boarding a steamship to New York by tomorrow night.
There is no power, means, force, blackmail, inducement, or other method of persuasion in this lifetime or in any other possible variation of this life that you could use to persuade me to travel with you tomorrow to Marseille, much less to America, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, said Henry James.
Chapter 6. The two men were alone in a first-class carriage compartment on the express train to Marseille, which was some comfort to Henry James, and for the first 3 hours of the trip, neither man spoke. James was pretending to read a novel. Holmes was behind the times. Suddenly, with neither warning nor prelude, Holmes lowered his paper and said,
"You had a beard then as well."
James looked up and stared. "I beg your pardon?"
Eventually, he would get used to Sherlock Holmes's sudden changes of topic or seemingly irrelevant announcements from the blue, but not this day, not yet.
5 years ago, said Holmes, when I was introduced to you at Mrs. T.P. O'Connor's garden party. You wore a full beard then as well.
James said nothing. He'd had that full beard since the Civil War.
It is partially how I recognized you in the dark along the Seine, said Holmes, and returned to his paper.
Finally, seeing a way to irritate his irritating compartment mate, James did speak.
I would think that the world's most famous consulting detective might rely upon more points of physiognomy for recognition than a man's beard.
Holmes laughed.
Of course. I see the physiognomy of men, not their added facial hair accoutrements. I am, for instance, somewhat of an expert on ears.
You didn't even remember we had been introduced, said James, ignoring the absurd comment about ears.
Not true, sir, laughed Holmes. I remember at the time that when I'd heard the American Mr. James was to be at the garden party, I'd hoped that it would be your brother, the psychologist, with whom I looked forward to discussing several things.
William hadn't yet published his Principles of Psychology in 1888, groused James. He was, to all intents and purposes, unknown to the world. How could you have known you wanted to talk to him? Your memory serves you poorly, Mr. Holmes.
Not a bit of it, chuckled the detective. Friends in America, friends who shared in some way my own peculiar vocation, had sent me copies of your older brother's various papers on psychology years before his full book appeared. But the primary reason I was distracted upon meeting you at Mrs. O'Connor's garden party, Mr. James, was that at that precise moment I was watching my suspect, the jewel thief, ply his trade. We caught him, as Watson would say, red-handed, although I admit to never having learned where that silly phrase, red-handed, came from.
A mere servant, you said last night, said James, looking back down at the hieroglyphics of the novel on his lap. He was too upset to read, which was a very rare occurrence for Henry James.
A mere servant, but one in the rather intimate employ of your very own Lady Wolseley, said Holmes.
James almost dropped his book.
One of Lord and Lady Wolseley's servants responsible for jewelry thefts, he cried. Impossible! Absurd!
Not at all, said Holmes. Lord Wolseley had paid me to solve the series of crimes that were plaguing his friends with such lovely country houses, but he needn't have bothered coming to me. A moderately competent village constable could have solved that simple crime. I knew who it was, or had narrowed the very small category containing the obvious culprit within hours of taking the case. You see,
The thefts had begun in various high English houses in Ireland. All the major English houses, in fact, save for Lord Wolseley's and a few English aristocrats there who were out of favor with Lord and Lady Wolseley.
Henry James wanted to object again, on various obscure personal grounds as well as logical ones, but he could not yet find the words.
"The chief thief's name was Jermond," continued Holmes. "Robert Jacob Jermond, a rather aging corporal who had served as the general's, Lord Wolseley's, batman and even valet on various campaigns, and in both the Irish military camps and at Lord Wolseley's estate on that Green Isle. One has to say that Corporal Jermond did not look the role of a jewel thief. He had a long, rather basset hound face with the accompanying luminous, sad, and sensitive eyes, but one look at the record of thefts within Lord Wolseley's regimental garrisons in Ireland over the years, and then amongst the homes of Lord W.'s friends in Ireland, and then again in England during his and Lady Wolseley's various visits home, and the identity of the mastermind, although I admit that it is far too grand to call him by that title, of this jewel theft ring was immediately obvious to even the least deductive mind. At the very moment you and I were meeting at the garden party, Mr. James, I was covertly watching Corporal Jermond go about his actual thieving. He was very smooth."
James felt himself blushing. He'd come to know several of Lord and Lady Wolseley's primary servants over the years, most of them former military men under the general. But Jermond had been assigned as his own personal servant during James's only visit so far to Ireland and Lord Wolseley's estate there. James had felt a strange affinity for the soft-spoken, sad-eyed, personal valet. James was not pleased that he and Holmes had to share a stateroom on the Paris, even though it was in first class and adequate to their needs. The booking had been so close to sailing time, Holmes had explained, that only a cancellation of this two-bed single stateroom had been available.
"Unless," he had added, "you would have preferred traveling in steerage, which I know from personal experience has its peculiar charms."
"I do not wish to be traveling on that ship, or any ship at all," had been James's rejoinder.
But save for the sleeping hours, the two saw little of each other. Holmes never went to breakfast, was rarely seen partaking of the rather good petit déjeuner in the morning dining area, was never glimpsed at lunchtimes, and only occasionally filled his assigned seat at the captain's table where, every evening in his black tie and tails, James tried to converse with the French aristocrats, German businessmen, ship's white-bearded captain, who seemed primarily interested in his food at any rate, and the single Englishwoman at the table, an almost dotty dowager who insisted on calling him Mr. Jane. James spent as much of each day at sea as he could, either browsing the ship's modest library, none of his works were there, even in translation, or pacing the not terribly spacious deck, or listening to the occasional desultory piano recital or small concert arranged for the passengers' amusement. But twice, Henry James had accidentally caught Sherlock Holmes in powerfully personal and embarrassing moments. The first time he'd surprised Holmes, who showed no surprise or embarrassment either time, had been after breakfast when James was returning to the shared stateroom in order to change his clothes. Holmes was lying, still in his nightshirt, on his bed, some sort of strap wrapped around the upper bicep of his left arm, and was just in the process of removing the needle of a syringe from the soft flesh at his inner elbow joint. On the bedside table, the table they had shared, the table on which James set his book when it came time to extinguish the lights, there was a vial of dark liquid that James had to assume was morphine. Henry James was not unacquainted with the delivery and effects of morphine. He had watched his sister Alice float off on its golden glow, away from all humanity, including her own, for months before her death. Catherine Loring had even been instructed by Alice's physician on how to administer the proper syringe amount of morphine should no one else be available. James had never been required to give his dying sister the injection, but he had been prepared to. Alice, in her final months the year before, had also received regular sessions of hypnosis, along with the morphia, in the concerted efforts to lessen her seemingly endless pain. But Sherlock Holmes was in no physical pain that Henry James knew of. He was simply now a morphine addict, after having been a cocaine injection addict for many years. And he'd already stated that he was eager to find and use this new heroic drug of Mr. Bayer's, since it was so available in the United States. Holmes had not been embarrassed. He'd simply looked up at James under heavy eyelids and calmly set away the bottle, syringe, and other apparatus in a small leather case James had already seen him carrying and assumed to be his shaving kit, and then smiled sleepily. Disgusted and making no efforts to hide that reaction, James had turned on his heel and left the room, despite the fact that he had not changed into his deck walking clothes. Another painfully intimate moment came when James entered the stateroom after a perfunctory knock late on the fourth night out from Dublin, only to find Holmes standing naked in front of the nightstand that held their water basin and small mirror. Again, Holmes showed no appropriate embarrassment and did not hurry to pull on his nightshirt, despite his stateroom mate's obvious discomfort. Henry James had seen grown men naked before. He tended to react in complicated ways to the naked male form, but his primary reaction was to think of death. When Henry James had been a toddler, he'd followed his brother William, older by just a year, everywhere William went. Henry couldn't and did not wish to keep up with William during his brother's rough and tumble years of outdoor play, but later, when William decided that he would become an artist, Henry decided that he would also become an artist. As many times as he could, he would join William in the drawing and painting classes their father paid for. One day, James entered the Newport drawing studio to find his orphaned cousin, Gus Barker, posing nude for the life drawing class. Shocked to his marrow by the beauty of his red-headed cousin, that paleness of skin, the flaccid penis so vulnerable, Gus's nipples so femininely pink against that white skin. James had pretended to an artist's professional interest only, scowling down at William's and others' drawings as if preparing to seize paper and stroke some lines of charcoal of his own to capture such an ineffable power of nakedness. But mostly young Henry James, the incipient writer in him rising more certainly than any specific sexual consciousness, was fascinated with his own layered and troubled response to his male cousin's calmly displayed body. Young Gus Barker was the first of their close circle of family and friends to die in the Civil War, cut down by some Confederate sniper's bullet in Virginia. For decades after that, Henry James could not think of his first shock of admiring the naked male form without thinking of that very form. The copper stippling of Gus's pubic hair, the veins on his muscled forearms, the strange power of his pale thighs, lying and rotting under the loam in some unknown Virginia field. After Henry James's youngest brother Wilkie was badly wounded during the Massachusetts 54th Black Regiment's ill-planned and disastrous attack on South Carolina's Fort Wagner, he had been in such terrible condition when he'd been brought home, found among the dying in an open army surgical station in South Carolina, and saved purely by the coincidence of family friend Cabot Russell there looking for his missing dead son on the battlefield, that they'd had to leave Wilkie on his filthy stretcher in the hallway entrance by the door for weeks. James had been with both his father and mother when they'd bathed their mutilated youngest child, and Wilkie's naked body was a different sort of revelation for young Henry James, Jr., a terrible wound in the back from which the Confederate ball had not yet been removed, and a sickening wound to the foot. They'd roughly operated on the boat bringing Wilkie north to remove that ball, that showed both decay and the early conditions of gangrene. The first time Henry had watched his brother naked on the cot, being turned and touched so gingerly by his mother after Wilkie's filthy-smelling uniform had been cut off, he had marveled at how absolutely vulnerable the male human body was to metal, fire, the blade, disease. In many ways, especially when turned, screaming onto his stomach,
so that they could bathe his back and legs. With both wounds now visible, Wilkie James looked more like a weak old corpse than like a living man, than like a brother. Then there was the other Holmes, whom James had seen naked. Near the end of the war, James's childhood friend, only 2 years older than Henry, but now aged decades by his war experiences, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., had come to visit James in Boston, and then traveled with him to North Conway, where James's cousin Minnie Temple and her sisters had lived. For the first night of that North Conway visit, this other Holmes and young James had been forced to share an absurdly Spartan room and single sagging bed before they found a more suitable rental the next day, and James, already in his pajamas and under the covers, had seen Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., standing naked in the lamplight in front of a wash basin and mirror, just as Sherlock Holmes was this night, somewhere in the tossing North Atlantic on the Paris. The young James had once again marveled at the beauty of the lean and muscled male body when Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. had stood there in the lamplight that night. But once again, there had been the all-too-visible connection with death, terrible scars radiating like white spiderwebs across Oliver's back and sides and upper leg. Indeed, that other Holmes, James's Holmes, had also been terribly wounded in the war, and was so proud of the fact that he would talk about it, in detail not usually allowed in front of ladies, for decades afterwards. That other Holmes, eventually to be the famous jurist, insisted on keeping his torn and bloody Union uniform, still smelling of gunpowder and blood and filth, just as Wilkie's cot and blanket and cutaway uniform had, in his wardrobe for all these decades to follow. He would take it out upon occasion of cigars and conversation with his fellow men of name and fortune, and show them the blood long dried brown and the ragged holes that so paralleled the white-webbed ragged holes James had glimpsed scarring his childhood friend's bare body. For James, it had been another glimpse not only at the beauty of the naked male form, but at the mutilating graffiti of death trying to claim the mortality of that form. So, even in his shock, Henry James was not surprised to see in the stateroom's dim lamplight that Mr. Sherlock Holmes, leaner even than Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., had been at an age 15 years Sherlock's junior, also had scars along his back, sides, and legs. These did not look like the bullet wounds James had seen in Wilkie's and Oliver's flesh, but rather like knife slashes or some zealot, flagellant, self-inflicted lashes that had cut through skin and flesh. "Excuse me," James had said, still standing in the open door to the stateroom. He did not know what he did not, so he stopped there. Holmes turned and looked at him. There were more white scars on his pale chest. James had time to note that despite the tall man's extreme thinness, his flanks were all but hollowed in the way of some runners and other athletes whom James had seen compete. Mr. Sherlock Holmes, whose flesh in the lamplight glowed almost as white as James's cousin Gus Barker's had been, was a mass of corded muscles which seemed just waiting to be flexed and used in some urgent circumstance. "Excuse me," James had said again, and had gone back out through the door. He stayed in the first-class lounge that night, smoking and reading some irrelevant magazine, until he was certain that Holmes would be in bed asleep before he himself returned to the stateroom. The Paris, far behind its own rather unambitious schedule, came into New York Harbor in early evening when part of the city's oldest skyline was backlit by the setting sun. Most of the transatlantic liners James had taken back from Europe over the years, if arriving in New York, did so early in the morning. He realized that this evening arrival was not only more aesthetically pleasing, although James could no longer tolerate the aesthetics of New York City, but also seemed somehow more appropriate to their covert mission. Holmes had joined him, uninvited, at the railing where James had been watching the scurry of tugboats and flurry of harbor traffic, listening to the hoots and bells and shouts of one of the world's busiest harbors.
"Interesting city, is it not?"
asked Holmes. "Yes," was James's only response.
When he'd left New York and America 10 years earlier in 1883, he'd vowed never to return. Safely back in Kensington, he had written essays about his American and New York impressions. The city itself, where James had enjoyed years of what he thought was a happy childhood in their home near Washington Square Park, had changed. James changed, beyond all recognition. Between the 1840s and the 1880s, he said, New York had become a city of immigrants and strangers. The civilities and certainties of the semi-rural, yet still pleasantly urban, Washington Square years had been replaced by these hurtling verticalities, these infusions of strange-smelling, strange-speaking foreigners. At one point, James had compared the Jews in their ghettos of the Lower East Side to rats and other vermin, scurrying around the feet of their distracted and outnumbered proper Anglo-Saxon predecessors. But he also admired the fact that these immigrants put out more daily newspapers in Hebrew than appeared in the city in English, that they had created a series of Yiddish theaters that entertained more people nightly, however boorishly and barbarically, than did the Broadway theaters, that the Jews and the Italians and other lower orders of immigrants, including most of the Irish, had made such a niche for themselves in the new New York that Henry James was certain that they could never, having attached themselves like limpets to that proud dream of America shared by so many of its inhabitants, be displaced. It had made Henry James feel like a stranger in his own land, in his own city, and his essays had returned to that theme again and again and again. He said nothing of that now, as he and Holmes silently watched the final preparations for the old liner to be nudged into its proper berth along the busy docks.
You will want to know how I knew that night along the Seine that you were carrying your sister Alice's ashes, Holmes said very softly.
People were shoving and milling to lean along the long railing now, but there nonetheless seemed to be a bubble of privacy around the two men.
I want to know nothing of the kind, returned James with equal softness but much more intensity. Your wild and inaccurate speculations do not interest me in the least, Mr. Holmes.
I had been there in the dark longer than you, continued Holmes, his eyes on the surrounding ships and fireboats and rowboats and busy mayhem. And my eyes had much better adapted to the dark than had yours. I saw you remove the small ivory snuff box several times, hold it in a way that almost might be called prayerful, return it to your inner pocket, then retrieve it again. I knew it was an ivory snuff box. Only ivory gleams that way in such low light. And I also knew at once that you did not take snuff.
You know nothing of my habits, sir.
James's voice could not have been colder nor more dismissive of this uninvited conversation. But because of the crowd behind them, he could not simply turn and walk away. He shifted his gaze away from Holmes instead.
I do, of course, said Holmes. A user of snuff, even an occasional user, has telltale nicotine stains on his thumb and second finger. You did not. Also, someone using a snuff box to retrieve pinches of snuff does not carefully and permanently join the various openings of the box with sealing wax.
There is no way you could have seen such things in those seconds, in that darkness, said James. His heart was pounding against his ribs.
I could. I did, said Sherlock Holmes. And then, as we were leaving, I contrived to light my pipe to confirm my earlier observations. You were not aware of it. Holding the snuff box obviously had become a nervous habit with you, Mr. James, especially in extremis, as it were. But you had removed it briefly several times after we'd walked away from the river. I could see that it was more than a mere talisman for you. It was sacred.
James turned angrily to stare at the intruder, and was shocked to see that Holmes had removed the blue lenses that had altered his true eye color. Now Henry James's coldly angry gray-eyed stare met the calm, gray-eyed gaze of Sherlock Holmes.
While I was in India, I'd read in the Times of your sister's death in March of 1892, and, later, a notice of Miss James's funeral and cremation at Woking,
and the mention that your sister's companion, Miss Catherine Peabody Loring, would be returning the ashes to Cambridge, America, for internment there at the family plot.
James said nothing. He continued to glare. He was glad he was leaning on a ship's railing because he thought he might be sick.
I could tell at once that night along the Seine that, with Miss Loring's and your family's knowledge, or more likely without it, you had appropriated some of your sister's ashes, made them safe in that absurdly expensive ivory snuffbox, and were transporting them. Somewhere. But where? Certainly not just to the bottom of the Seine.
James could not remember ever being insulted in quite this intimate fashion before. If he were his brother William, he knew he would strike this Holmes in the face as brutally and bruisingly as possible. But Henry James was not William. He had never in his life coiled his fist in real expectation of striking another boy or man. He did not do so now. He continued to glare.
I think perhaps, concluded Holmes, that you were considering a voyage back to America anyway, before your melancholy overtook you in Paris, I mean. I believe that earlier thought of a voyage to America is why you finally changed your mind last night about joining me on this mission. Perhaps you thought to scatter your sister's ashes at some spot important, sacred to both of you. It is not, of course, any of my business. But I respect your bereavement, sir, and I shall not raise this subject again. I did so now primarily to acquaint you with some of the simpler methods of my powers of observation and ratiocination.
I am not impressed, sir, said James when at last he could speak. But he was. Despite himself, he was very impressed. The old ship was being settled up against the wharf like a matron being led to a groaning buffet. French sailors, fore and aft, made ready to toss the ropes that would precede the massive cables that would soon pull them tight to America.
You'll pardon me, Mr. Holmes. I forgot something in the stateroom. I shall meet you when you clear customs inspection.
Holmes nodded, seemingly lost in his own thoughts. James knew that Holmes, as Jan Sigerson, traveling on what he presumed to be a false Norwegian passport, would be held up for some time in line while Henry James, expatriate at heart but still traveling on his American passport, would pass through with only the most cursory inspection. Still, he trundled quickly back to the stateroom in the hopes that the porters they'd given orders to had not yet taken down the bags and steamer trunks. They had not. James locked the door to the stateroom behind him, unlocked his steamer trunk, removed a mahogany box from a recessed area, and opened it carefully. The interior was custom-lined in velvet, with an indentation cut to his prescribed dimensions. James withdrew the snuffbox from his waistcoat pocket, set it carefully within the mahogany box, locked the steamer trunk again, made sure he had his passport and papers ready in his briefcase, and left the stateroom just as the porters arrived to haul away the luggage. They touched their caps as they passed, and Henry James nodded in return.
Chapter 7. I had planned on describing to you Holmes's and James's one evening, night, and morning in New York City, but I could find no record of where they stayed. I have the records of both of them clearing customs by 7 p.m., Thursday evening, 23 March, 1893. Holmes under his J. Sigerson Norwegian Nationals passport, James under his own name, but lost track of them in the hours after that. Based on the dialogue I know they had on the train to Washington the next day, it's possible that they did not dine together that night or even stay in the same hotel. It appears as if they hadn't spoken since Holmes's intrusive explanation along the rail of the French steamship Paris as they were docking. I had also assumed that they would have taken one of the Washington, D.C. bound trains from the conveniently located Grand Central Depot that Friday, the 24th of March, but it turns out that Holmes, who had been in charge of all their rushed travel arrangements, had booked them on the Boston-Washington, D.C. Express called the Colonial, or sometimes the Colonial Express, a service provided jointly by the Pennsylvania Railroad and New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad. But in 1893, the Colonial did not yet come into Manhattan or connect to Grand Central Depot.
That change would be made after the Titanic sank in 1912, and Holmes and James would have had to have arisen early and taken one of several early ferries to Jersey City, there to board the Colonial that would take them down the Pennsylvania Main Line to Philadelphia, Baltimore, and finally Washington. It was the fastest express available to them on that Friday, but not the most convenient for someone who had spent the night in Manhattan. I did confirm that Henry James had sent John Hay a hurried cable from Marseille, stating only that he was coming back to America for private and personal reasons. Please tell no one except perhaps Henry A., and gave the date and rough time of his arrival in Washington, and told his old friend that he and a Norwegian explorer whom I have befriended and who is temporarily traveling with me would find lodging in a Washington hotel. James received, upon arrival in New York, a cable from John Hay, saying, in full, "Nonsense. You and your traveling companion must stay with us for the duration of your visit. Clara and I insist. There shall be room and food and wine and conversation enough for all. Adams is currently away traveling, but will be thrilled that you have decided to visit your home country again. By great good coincidence, the diplomatic attaché from King Oscar II, King of Sweden and Norway, is scheduled to be our dinner guest on Sunday night. We all look forward to meeting your intrepid explorer friend." James showed Holmes the cable on their way to the Jersey City terminal and could not resist a grim smile. "A bit of a problem, perhaps?"
"What is that, my dear fellow?"
said Holmes as they waited at the front of the ferry.
"Does the disguise of Mr. Jan Sigerson include a native's facility with the Norwegian language?"
James asked most pointedly.
"Perhaps you had better stay at a Washington hotel, visit Hay and Adams only upon careful occasion, and be indisposed this coming Sunday evening."
"Nonsense," said Holmes, and smiled. "It is a great advantage to stay with the Hays. You said that their home was near that of Henry Adams?"
"Next door and contiguous," said James, "just like Sweden and Norway."
"There you have it, then," said Holmes. "We shall leave the representative of King Oscar II of Sweden and Norway to sort things out for himself on Sunday."
Their rail tickets were nominally first class, but there was nothing resembling a private compartment. Luckily, the first class carriage was not crowded this Friday morning, and while sitting across the aisle from each other, Holmes and James could lean forward and converse in private when they wished. James also noticed that while the disgusting American male habit of constant expectoration had not disappeared, there seemed to be somewhat fewer spittoons visible everywhere than there had been in the early 1880s during his last visit, and the red runner down the aisle of the first-class carriage was not so spongily porous with liquefied tobacco as so many rugs and carpets had been 10 years earlier. James had decided in 1883 that he could never again live in and possibly never again visit America if it was only because of the universal spitting.
"Tell me about the Five Hearts," said Holmes as they left Philadelphia.
For this conversation, the detective had crossed the aisle and was sitting uncomfortably close to James, knee to knee, as it were, and was perched on the north-facing seat across from the south-facing writer. Holmes leaned on his Northern European-style walking stick. James wished that he had brought a stick to the compartment, if only to use as a barrier between them. James set his palms firmly on his knees as if that created a structure separating them further.
"In truth," he said, "they referred to their small group not as the Five Hearts, but as the Five of Hearts."
"Tell me then about the Five of Hearts," said Holmes.
"In truth, it was Clover Adams' salon," said James. "A very uniquely American salon, I might say."
"How so?"
James paused a second to comprehend exactly what he had meant.
"It was not, as are so many scores of salons I've known in France and Italy and elsewhere, centered on things or people literary, nor upon artists and art, nor upon that most central trinity of salons, money, aristocracy, or notoriety,
Although the Adamses might not be found wanting in any of the three of those categories.
Really? Said Holmes. I thought there was no aristocracy in the United States of America.
James smiled almost pityingly at the younger man. James was turning 50 in a few weeks, and Holmes had mentioned that he was currently 38 years old, turning 39 in April. But at this moment, Henry James felt very much the wiser, older gentleman.
Every society has its subtle aristocracies, Mr. Holmes. Mr. Sigerson. If not based on birth, then upon wealth. If not upon wealth, then upon power, and so forth.
Yet isn't Henry Adams a member of the ruling aristocracy in Washington?
Asked Holmes. James frowned before answering. Was the insufferable detective trying to be provocative? Pretending to be dense? After a few seconds of thought, James decided not. He was simply naive.
Henry Adams is a grandson of one American president and the great-grandson of another, both on his paternal side, of course, but he has never held any political power of his own. He is rich, yes. He and Clover were at the center of Washington's social power in the first half of the 1880s, yes. But while being a member of what French philosophers or Jefferson might have called a natural aristocracy, Adams never controlled power, per se. I mean, he started as a Harvard professor, for heaven's sake.
Holmes nodded.
Let us return to Mrs. Adams. Describe your former friend, Clover, to me, as briefly and succinctly as you can, please.
James felt his infinitely delicate feathers ruffle again at this peremptory command.
You are asking me to reveal personal details of a dear departed friend of mine and the wife of a friend of mine, sir, he said stiffly. You must remember that I am, while not English by nationality, a gentleman, and there are things which gentlemen simply cannot do.
Holmes sighed.
Right now, Mr. James, and for the foreseeable future, you are an American gentleman who has agreed to help solve the possible murder, or at least the mystery surrounding someone annually claiming her death to be murder, of a fellow American citizen. In that sense, sir, your responsibilities to your friend as a witness outweigh vague conceptions of gentlemen not discussing their friends. We must both get beyond that if we are to decide whether your friend Clover Adams was murdered or not.
Easy for you to get beyond it, thought James. You are not a gentleman.
He sighed aloud.
Very well. What do you wish to know about Clover?
Her appearance, to begin with.
James felt himself bridle again.
Why should her appearance be a factor, Mr. Sigerson? Do you have the theory that someone murdered her because of her looks? It is a simple piece of a complex puzzle,
Holmes said quietly.
And somewhere to start. What did Clover Adams look like?
James paused again. Eventually, he said,
Shall we say that Henry Adams did not marry Miss Marion Hooper in June of 1873 for her beauty alone? She was plain-looking, although, as Henry himself once wrote to me years ago, she should not quite be called plain. And she was petite. But Henry Adams, as perhaps you will see, is also a small man by modern standards. But although it was not unduly sharpened by education, Clover had a lively and intelligent mind.
He hesitated again.
And I must admit,
a quick and acerbic tongue. During the 5 years they lived in Washington before her death, Clover made many enemies, especially amongst social climbers, shunned senators and their wives.
So you would categorize this Five of Hearts salon at which she was the center as more exclusionary than not?
Asked Holmes. James wished again that he had brought his walking stick into the carriage, to lean on as he thought this time.
Yes, definitely, he replied softly,
more to himself, it sounded, than to the detective sitting across from him.
Henry and Clover Adams, and the other three members of the Five of Hearts,
would never invite someone to their inner circle because of that person's power or notoriety. Rather, they invited artists, writers, minor politicians, and such to the dinners held after the 5 o'clock daily teas of the inner salon of the Five of Hearts, based on that person's ability to amuse them. I once wrote a story in which I portrayed Clover Adams in the form of a certain Mrs. Bonnycastle, and... James stopped in mid-breath. He was aghast at his own lack of discretion.
"Go on," said Sherlock Holmes.
James took a breath. Well, he had already crossed the discretionary Rubicon, as it were. "It was in a story called Pandora," said Henry James. "But you must understand that I never base any of my fictional characters on actual living or deceased persons. They are always an amalgam of experience and pure fiction."
This was as disingenuous as Henry James could get. All of his important characters, and most of his minor ones, were based exactly and precisely upon living or deceased personages from his own life and experience.
"Of course," purred Holmes, sounding as disingenuous as Henry James felt.
"At any rate, in this short story, I described Mrs. Bonnycastle as a lady of infinite mirth, and her salon as one which left out, on the whole, more than it took in."
"But you've already told me that the actual Clover Adams was not exactly a lady of infinite mirth," interrupted Holmes. "You've explained that she had been, since childhood, visited by deep and frequent spells of melancholy."
"Yes, yes," James said impatiently. "One omits certain features of a character for a short story. Had Mrs. Bonnycastle been a central character in a novel, well, we would have had to explore all sides of her, even those that seem, upon first glance, to be mutually contradictory."
"Please go on," said Holmes, almost contritely. "You were describing your fictional treatment of Clover of Mrs. Bonnycastle's salon."
"I remember writing that the very rare senator or congressman whom they allowed to visit was invariably inspected with, I remember the precise words, Mr. Holmes, with a mixture of alarm and indulgence." Holmes smiled thinly. It looked as if he wanted to ask James whether the writer could remember verbatim large tracts from his dozens of books and hundreds of short stories, but he obviously did not want to derail the conversation again.
"Go on, please," he said.
"I know," continued James, "that my good friend Henry Adams recognized himself in the story Pandora when I described Mr. Bonnycastle as having once said to his wife, in a fit of unusual broad-mindedness, 'Hang it, let us be vulgar and have some fun. Let us invite the president.'"
"And did they regularly invite the president?" asked Holmes.
James made an almost impolite noise.
"Not that worm, James Garfield," said the writer, "although I imagine that Garfield would have galloped barefoot across Lafayette Square to the Adamses' home, should he have ever been tendered. But they did, or at least Henry did, I believe for the first time with their architect Richardson, cross the street to visit the White House once Grover Cleveland came to power in March of 1885, only a few months before Clover's death."
Holmes raised a single finger.
"Pardon me for interrupting again, James, but this is something else about America that confuses me a trifle. It was my understanding, at least in my childhood, that unlike Her Majesty or most other royalty worldwide, American presidents were elected for a limited period of time. 4 years was my hazy recollection. Yet President Cleveland was in office when Clover Adams died in 1885. And correct me if I am wrong, he is in office now in the spring of 1893. Have the Americans discovered the benefits of lifetime public service?"
"Can any grown Englishman really be so ill-informed?" wondered Henry James.
As if reading James's mind, Holmes smiled and said,
"During a railway voyage in a recent case set far out on distant moors, one not mentioned
so far at least, in his published chronicles of our adventures, I had the opportunity to reveal to Dr. Watson that, until he had mentioned it in passing that day, I had no idea that the Earth went around the sun. I may have learned it at one time, I explained to Watson, but, as with all things that do not relate directly to my profession and avocation of detective work, I quickly put it out of my mind. I can, you shall find, be rather singularly focused, so you will have to make allowances for me at times, sir.
But for a man who brags of being set so firmly behind the times, James began and stopped. Holmes could not possibly be telling the truth here, and James wanted no argument. Not yet. Mr. Grover Cleveland, he began again, is in the unique position of being the only president of the United States who has served two non-consecutive four-year terms. He was in office between March 1885 and March of 1889. After a four-year interval where a certain Benjamin Harrison served in the office, Mr. Cleveland was elected again just last November and was sworn into office again only a few weeks ago. Holmes nodded briskly.
Thank you. And please return to your description of all five of the Five of Hearts.
James looked around. I fear that the dining car will be closing for luncheon service soon. Perhaps we could have a late lunch and continue our discussion there? Chapter 8. James chose trout for lunch. He didn't care that much for trout, but eating it always reminded him that he was home in the United States. Actually, nothing outside the window of the moving dining car gave him any sense of being home. The trees along the rail line here as they moved from New Jersey toward Baltimore were too small, too tightly clustered, and too obviously just stands of new growth where farms had spared a patch of forest. The farmhouses were of wood and often needed new coats of paint. Some of the barns sagged. It was a tapestry of American chaos overlaid on a layer of poverty. England and Italy and France had more than enough poverty, Henry James knew well enough, but it rarely manifested itself as sagging, unpainted, wildly planted chaos. In England, in most of James's Europe, the old and poor and run down were picturesque, including the people. Many years earlier, in an essay on Hawthorne, who had been an early passion of his, James had made the mistake of writing to American readers that American soil and history were a sad, blank slate for any American writer, poet, or artist. New England, he had pointed out, lacked Europe's all-important castles, ancient ruins, Roman roads, abandoned sheepherders' cottages, and defined social classes capable of appreciating art. American artists of any sort, he'd suggested, could never achieve a real mastery of their art by reacting to the vulgar, pressing, profit-centered, and always pressing new, the way writers and artists in Europe could react romantically to the old. Certain American reviewers, editors, and even readers had taken him to task for these less-than-praise-filled paragraphs. In their eyes, James knew, America, even without any true history, could do no wrong, and the vulgar and ever-shifting newness that he hated so profoundly, primarily as an impediment to his and any American writer's art, was an aphrodisiac to their Philistine and American-tuned senses. James remembered writing in 1879 or thereabouts, putting down his thoughts on Hawthorne and his contemporaries. It takes a great deal of history to produce a little literature, and one might enumerate the items of high civilization, as it exists in other countries, which are absent from the texture of American life, until it should become a wonder to know what was left. Perhaps this is why he had added, in chapter 6 of his Hawthorne book, "It is, I think, an indisputable fact that Americans are, as Americans, the most self-conscious people in the world, and the most addicted to the belief that the other nations of the earth are in a conspiracy to undervalue them." No, it had not made him popular to American readers and reviewers. Now James shrugged and set all that ancient emotion away from his thoughts
as he finished his trout and sipped the last of his less than mediocre white wine. Holmes had ordered only tea, and then let the poor American imitation of his choice sit unsipped in its Pennsylvania and New York, New Haven, and Hartford railroad-crested cup. James was not certain that he'd seen the detective actually eat anything since their dinner in Paris on the evening of March 13th, now 11 days in the past, and was beginning to wonder how the gaunt detective stayed alive.
"We were talking about Mrs. Clover Adams,"
Holmes said so suddenly that it startled James.
"Were we? I thought we had moved on to her husband and other members of the Five of Hearts."
James made sure that no one was seated in their half of the emptying dining car or any waiter within earshot before he spoke, and even then he spoke very softly.
"You mentioned that Clover made enemies, partially through excluding people from her salon, but also with her wit. Perhaps you said because of her sharp tongue," said Holmes. "Can you give me some examples of her saying or writing specific things that hurt specific people?"
James dabbed at his lips with the linen napkin as he thought about this. Then, in a choice so rare as to be all but unique, he chose to share a story in which he had been the butt of the joke.
"The last time I was here in America," he said, "a decade ago, I wrote to Clover before boarding my ship back to England.